Good, she said. She took my little finger and bent it back and would have snapped it if I didn't snatch it away. Genet slept in a bed made up for her in our living room. The next morning, before we went to school, Hema sent for Rosina. Shiva, Genet, and I snuck into the corridor to listen. I peeked, and I saw Rosina standing before Hema the way she'd stood before the army man. I expect to see you back in the kitchen helping Almaz. And from now on, in the daytime, the door and window to your quarters stay open. Let some light and air in there. If Rosina was going to make claims on her daughter, this was the moment. We held our breath. She didn't say a word. She made a curt bow and left. We fell back into our school routine. Loads of homework, then Hema work, which included penmanship, current affairs discussions, vocabulary and book reports. Cricket for me and Shiva, and dance for Shiva and Genet. Many an evening, Ghosh bowled to us on a makeshift pitch on our front lawn. For a large man, he had a delicate touch with the bat and taught us how to sweep, to drive, and to square cut. Shiva was, as of that year, exempt from school assignments, the result of Hema and Ghosh negotiating with his teachers at Loomis Town and Country. Both sides were relieved. Shiva didn't have to write an essay on the Battle of Hastings if he saw no point to it. Loomis Town and Country would collect Shiva's fees and let him attend class since he wasn't disruptive. Shiva didn't mind the ritual of school. The teachers knew us and they understood Shiva as well as one could understand Shiva. But just like Mr. Bailey, newly arrived from Bristol, some teachers had to discover Shiva for themselves. Bailey was the only teacher in LTNC's history to have a degree, and therefore he felt obliged to set a very high standard. 2/3 of us failed the first math test.
One of you scored a perfect 100, but he or she didn't write a name on the paper. The rest of you were miserable. 66% of you failed, he exclaimed. What do you think about that number? 66.
For Shiva, rhetorical questions were a trap. He never asked a question to which he knew the answer. Shiva raised his hand. I cringed in my seat. Mr. Bailey's eyebrow went up, as if a chair in the corner which he'd managed to ignore for a few months had suddenly developed delusions that it was alive.
You have something to say?
66 is my second favorite number, Shiva said.
Pray, why is it your second favorite? Said Bailey. Because if you take the numbers you can divide into 66, including 66, and add them up, what you have is a square.
Mr. Bailey couldn't resist. He wrote down 1, 2, 3, 6, 11, 22, 33, and 66. All the numbers that went into 66. And then he totaled. What he got was 144, at which point both he and Shiva said,
12 squared!
That's what makes 66 special, Shiva said.
It's also true of 3, 22, 66, 70. Their divisors add up to a square.
Pray, tell us what's your favorite number, Bailey said, no sarcasm in his voice anymore,
since 66 is your second favorite.
Shiva jumped up to the board, uninvited, and wrote 10,213,223. Bailey studied this for a long while, turning a bit red. Then he threw up his hands in a gesture that struck me as very ladylike.
And pray, why would this number interest us?
The first four numbers are your license plate. From Mr. Bailey's expression, I didn't think he was aware of this.
That's a coincidence, Shiva went on. This number, Shiva said, tapping on the board with the chalk, getting as excited as Shiva allowed himself to get, is the only number that describes itself when you read it. 10, 2 ones, 3 twos, and 2 threes. Then my brother laughed in delight, a sound so rare that our class was stunned. He brushed chalk off his hands, sat down, and he was done. It was the only bit of mathematics that stayed with me from that year. As for the student who scored 100%, whoever it was had drawn a picture of Veronica on the test paper in lieu of a name. I mulled over our fates, especially the good fortune that let him skip homework. I suppose I understood. Since Shiva couldn't do or wouldn't do what was required of him, he was no longer required to do it. Since I could, I had to. Shiva went to version clinic whenever our school schedule allowed. He'd managed to make his way into one of Hema surgeries, a cesarean section, and now he was hooked. Gray's Anatomy became his Bible, and he drew at a frenetic pace, pages of his drawings littering our room. His subject was no longer just BMW parts or Veronica, but sketches showing the vulva and uterus and uterine blood vessels. To control the proliferation of paper, Hema insisted he draw in exercise books, which he did, filling page after page. You rarely saw Shiva without his grays in his hand. Perhaps, as a reaction to Shiva, I'd seek out Ghosh after school. I knew his haunts. Operating Theatre 3, Casualty, the post-op ward. My clinical education was gathering speed. Sometimes I assisted him with the vasectomies, which he did in his old bungalow. Genet and I sat down one evening, practicing our penmanship by copying out a page of aphorisms from Bickham's before beginning our homework. I looked up and was startled to see hot tears in her eyes. If virtue is its own reward, she said suddenly, then my father should be alive, no? And if truth needs no disguise, why do we have to pretend that his majesty isn't short, or that his affection for his ugly dog is normal? You know he has a servant whose only job is to carry around 30 pillows of different sizes to place at his majesty's feet, so that whatever throne he sits on, his feet don't dangle in the air? Come on, Genet, don't talk that way, I said, unless you want to have your neck stretched. Even before the coup, it was heresy to speak against His Majesty. People went to the gallows for less. After the coup, you had to be 10 times more careful. I don't care. I hate him. You can tell anyone you want. She stormed off. When the school term drew to a close, Rosina dropped a bombshell. She asked for leave to return to the north of the country, to Asmara, the heart of Eritrea. She wanted to take Genet with her to meet her family and to meet Zimui's parents. Hema feared she wouldn't return, and so she recruited Almaz and Gibru to try to talk Rosina out of it, or have her go alone. But Rosina was adamant. In the end, Genet solved the problem. No matter what, she told Hema, I'll be back. But I do want to see my relatives. When their taxi to the bus depot pulled away, Genet waved happily. She'd been so excited about the 3-day journey, and she could talk of nothing else. But for me, and for Hema, it was heartbreaking. That very night, the wind picked up, the leaves were swishing and rustling, and by morning a squall arrived, heralding the long rains. Now that I was about to turn 13, I was aware that for Matron, Pacelli, and Ghosh, and for Missing Hospital, the rainy season meant the croup, diphtheria, and measles season. There was no let-up in the work. One morning, as I went down to the gate, umbrella in hand, I saw a woman coming up the hill to Missing, rivulets of water pouring off her umbrella. She looked frightened. I recognized her. She worked in one of the bars in the cinder block buildings opposite Missing. Some mornings I saw her looking much as she did now, a plain and pleasant face, wearing a homely cotton skirt and top. I'd also seen her at night, her hair teased out, wearing heels, jewelry, elegant clothes, and looking glamorous. She asked me for directions. Her name was Sige, I learned later. I heard the muted, glottic, honking cough coming from the infant slung to her back in a shama, papoose fashion. It was a sound like a cry of a gander, and for that reason I bypassed casualty and took Sige directly to the croup room. The croup room was at other times the diarrhea dehydration room. A lab bench ran along the four walls, its surface covered with red rubber sheets. A curtain rod at head height circled the room, and intravenous bottles were suspended from this. In a pinch, missing could resuscitate up to 16 or even 20 infants packed side by side on that bench. The baby's eyes were screwed shut, the fingers curled, the tiny translucent nails leaving marks in the palm. The rise and fall of the little chest seemed too fast for a four-month-old. The nurse found a scalp vein and hooked up an intravenous drip. Ghosh arrived and quickly examined the little fellow. He let me listen with his stethoscope. It seemed impossible for such a tiny chest to be so full of squeaks, whistles, wheezes, and rattles. Over the left side, the heartbeat was so rapid I couldn't imagine how such a pace could be sustained. "You see these bowed legs? The lumpy bossing on the forehead," Ghosh said, "and the hot cross bun pattern on the top of the skull? These are the stigmata of rickets." Stigmata in my religion class at LT&C meant the nail wounds, the cuts from the crown of thorns, the gash made by the spear of Longinus in Christ's flesh. But Ghosh used the word to mean the flesh signs of a disease. In the piazza, he had once pointed out the stigmata of congenital syphilis in a listless boy who was squatting on the sidewalk. Saddle nose, cloudy eyes, peg-shaped incisor teeth. I read about the other stigmata of syphilis: mulberry molars, saber-shin tibias, and deafness. All the infants in the croup room appeared related because they all had the stigmata of rickets to a greater or lesser degree. They were wizened, bug-eyed with big foreheads. Ghosh put the child in the crude oxygen tent fashioned out of a plastic sheet. "The croup following measles, on top of malnutrition, on top of rickets," he said to me under his breath. "It's the cascade of catastrophes." Ghosh took Sige aside, his Amharic surprisingly fluent as he explained what was going on. He cautioned her to keep breastfeeding, no matter what you hear from anyone else. When Sige said the child was hardly sucking, he said, "Still, it will comfort him because he will know you are there. You are a good mother. This is hard." Sige tried to kiss Ghosh's hand when he left, but he'd have none of it. "I'll try to check on this baby later," Ghosh said on his way out. "We have a vasectomy tonight. Dr. Cooper from the American Embassy is coming to learn. Would you bring over a sterilized vasectomy pack from the operating theater and plug in the sterilizer in my quarters?" I stayed in the croup room with Sige because I sensed that she had no one else. Her infant looked no better. I thought of the shops on Churchill Road and how I'd seen tourists stop there, thinking it was a flower shop or flower market, only to find that the flowers were wreaths. Then they noticed the shoebox-sized coffins, just for infants. Tears streamed down Sige's face. She could see her baby was the sickest one there. The other mothers withdrew as if she were bad luck. At one point, I held her hand. I searched for words of comfort, but realized I didn't need any. When her baby began grunting with each breath, Sige cried on my shoulder. I wished Genet were with me. Whatever she was doing in Asmara surely couldn't be as meaningful as this. Genet said she wanted to be a doctor. For a smart kid growing up at missing, perhaps it seemed inevitable. And yet, Genet had an aversion to the hospital and had no interest in following Ghosh or Hema around. Even if she were an Addis, I couldn't see her sitting here with Sige. At 3 that afternoon, Sige's child died. It had been like watching a slow drowning. The effort of breathing ultimately proved too much for that tiny chest. At once, the staff nurse ran out in the rain to the main hospital, just as she'd been instructed to do. She gestured for me to follow, but I stayed put. A parent's grief needed a scapegoat, and parents were occasionally moved to violence, to exacting retribution on those who tried to help. I knew I had nothing to fear from Sige. Half an hour later, Sige held the shrouded body in her arms, ready for his voyage home. Belatedly, the other mothers gathered around Sige. They raised their mouths to the heavens, the veins on their necks forming cords. Lulululululululu, they cried, hoping their lament might weave some protection around their infants. I walked with Sige to the gate. There, she turned to me, her eyes full of pain. We held each other's gaze for what seemed like a long time. She bowed, then carried her bundle away. I felt so sad for her. Her baby suffering had ended, but hers had just begun. Dr. Cooper arrived promptly at 8 that evening in an embassy staff car, just as the patient, a Polish gentleman, pulled up in his kombi. Ghosh had learned the technique of vasectomy as an intern, and he'd learned directly from Javer in India, whom he spoke of as the maestro of male nut clipping who is personally responsible for millions of people not being here. The operation was a novelty in Ethiopia, and now expatriate men, particularly Catholics, came to Ghosh in increasing numbers for an operation that was uncommon or unavailable in their countries. I have a proposition for you, Dr. Cooper. I shall teach you the vasectomy, and once you are proficient, you can pay me back by doing a vasectomy on a VIP patient.
Do I know him? Cooper asked.
You are talking to him, Ghosh said. So you see, I have a vested interest in seeing you are superbly trained. My assistant, Marion, will help me judge your skills. Marion, not a word to Hema. You either, Cooper, about my plans, please. Cooper had a stiff brush cut and overlapping square teeth that looked like chiclets. His American accent was sharp, jarring to the ear, but offset by the way he drawled out his words, by his relaxed, affable manner, as if he'd never had an unpleasant moment in his life and did not expect to.
See one, do one, teach one. Right, old buddy? Cooper said.
Indeed, yes, Ghosh said. It's easy to do, but harder than it looks. Some preliminaries, Dr. Cooper. I tell the patient to use an enema the night before, because nothing makes them more tense than being constipated. Warm milk and honey mixed together and put into an enema bag held shoulder high is what I recommend.
Does it work?
Does it work? Let me put it this way. If the patient happens to be drinking a whiskey and soda, it'll suck the glass right out of his hand.
Gotcha, said Cooper.
I also ask the patient to take a warm bath beforehand. It relaxes him, he added sotto voce. And it improves my olfactory experience, you know?
The patient hadn't said a word thus far. He was, Ghosh had told me, a consultant to the Economic Commission for Africa, an expert on population control who happened to be the father of 5 girls. He didn't mind all the attention.
We can't finish if we don't start, so we better start, yes? Marion, the heater, please.
I'd already turned on the electric heater under the table.
Here is the first caveat. If you don't want the scrotum to shrivel up and the balls to retract to the armpit, the room has to be really warm. Now, the second caveat is relaxation. Very important. A barbiturate or narcotic might help. I recommend an ounce of Johnny Walker Red or Black. I'm not particular. A wonderful relaxant. And yes, you might give one to the patient too.
Cooper's laugh rolled leisurely out of his mouth, like the great banks of clouds that spill over the Entoto Mountains. I hoped Cooper was paying attention. I'd seen it before, when the patient's private parts were first exposed, even when the room was warm, the scrotal skin, the dartos muscle, would wrinkle and shrink, and the cremaster muscle would tug the testes up. Then, after a good swallow of whiskey by the patient, which was served only at this point and not before, the sac unfurled. Both surgeons were gloved, and Ghosh cleaned the area thoroughly, and then draped sterile towels to frame the field. "Another tip, Dr. Cooper. Even though it's a simple operation, mustn't allow any bleeding. Do you know what a brinjal looks like, Dr. Cooper?"
"I don't believe I do, no sir," Cooper said.
"Aubergine? Melanzana? Eggplant?"
Cooper recognized the last word.
"Well, if you don't meticulously control bleeding, you'll have an eggplant. Or two. And you know what we call that complication, Cooper. We call it the bloody brinjal and bugger all.
Which is also what they have fed us for 5 years in my medical school hostel."
I served the patient his Johnny Walker, which he downed in one gulp. I loved assisting Ghosh. Ever since he treated me as if I were old enough to learn and understand, I took my role very seriously. I was thrilled to have Cooper there watching. Ghosh, on the patient's right, rooted with his thumb and index finger at the top of the scrotum, just where it joined the body.
"You feel all the wiry things? Lymph vessels, arteries, nerves and whatnot? Well, the vast difference is in that lot. And with practice, you can tell it apart from all the other wires. It has the largest wall-to-lumen ratio of any tubular structure in the body, believe it or not. Here it is, a whip-like structure. Put your finger behind mine." Cooper rooted around and said,
"Got it, the vas, yep."
"Now, push the vas forward from the back with the tip of your index finger. Fix it like this against the pulp of your finger so that it doesn't slip away."
Ghosh's instructions to Cooper were similar to what he said to me when I assisted him. He loved to teach, and in Cooper he had the kind of student he deserved. If he dazzled Cooper with his polished delivery, it was because he'd practiced it on me. Practicing medicine and teaching medicine were completely connected for Ghosh. When there was no one to instruct, he suffered. But that was rare. He would happily teach a probationer or even a family member, whoever happened to be around.
"I use adrenaline with my local anesthetic to keep the bleeding minimal. And don't be stingy."
He emptied a 5cc syringe of local into the tissue that his index finger pushed forward.
"Any less than that, and he'll have pain and the balls will go to the armpit. You'll have to call a chest surgeon to bring them down. Now, see how my index finger still has the vas stretched over it? I make a tiny cut in the scrotal skin. I keep pushing on the vas, pushing it forward, and... there. When I can see it in the wound, I use an Alice to grab the vas."
He pulled out a short length of pale, white, worm-like tissue.
"I put a mosquito clip here and here. And then I cut between the clips. I remove a 2-centimeter segment. Ideally, you'll send it to pathology. That way, if his wife gets pregnant a year from now, you can show the patient the pathology report, and he'll know it's not because you didn't do your job, but because a third party did his job better. I don't send it to pathology for the simple reason that we don't have a pathologist. But for a while, there was a pathologist in the American Embassy Clinic in Beirut. I'd do the vasectomies for the American staff and send him these little pieces I cut out. The man did the pathology for all the American embassies in East and West Africa. He kept sending back reports that my specimens were inadequate. Though he thought he saw some uroepithelial tissue, he couldn't be certain it was the vas. It's the vas, I wrote him each time. What other uroepithelial tissue could I have cut out? Call it the vas. But he kept complaining, cannot be certain, not enough tissue.
It was starting to annoy me, you know? So finally, I sent him a pair of sheep's balls. I put them in formalin and sent them off in the same diplomatic pouch, with a note. Is this enough tissue? Never had a problem with him after that. Cooper hee-hawed, his mask sucking in and out. Now, I tie off the cut ends with catgut. And then I tell the patient, no communication with wife allowed for the next 90 days. Ghosh turned to face the patient and repeated the sentence. The patient nodded. Okay, you can communicate, say good morning, darling, and all that, but no sex for 3 months. The patient grinned. Okay, you can have sex, but you must wear a condom. I use interrupt this, the patient said, speaking for the first time in a heavy East European accent. You use what? Interrupt this? Pull and pray? Good God, man, no wonder you have 5 kids. It's noble of you to try to get off the train at an earlier station, but it's unreliable. No, sir. Interrupt the interruptus, man, unless you want to reach your 6 this year. The patient looked embarrassed. You know what we call young men who use coitus interruptus? Ghosh said. The population expert shook his head. We call them father, daddy, pater, papa, père. No, sir. I have done the interrupting for you. Give me 3 months and you can tell your missus that she is not to worry because you will be shooting blanks and there will be no more interruptions. And you will be staying for dessert, coffee and cigars. Chapter 31 The Dominion of the Flesh. With Gennett and Rosina away, our quarters felt empty. I missed Gennett terribly. Hema and I both worried that we'd never see her again. She promised to call and write, but 3 weeks had gone by and we'd yet to hear from her. That year, 1968, we had torrential rains. The Blue Nile and Awash had spilled their banks, causing flooding. The babbling brook behind Missing looked like a river. In Addis, the populace was bottled up indoors so that a lull in the rain released the scent of stifled humanity, dung fires, and clothes that refused to dry. The ivy raced up the drainpipes and found chinks in walls, while the tadpoles hurried into croaking frogs before their limbs were fully formed. No child I knew was ever tempted to turn its face to the sky and catch raindrops on the tongue, not when you lived and breathed water. Now that Shiva and I were teenagers, looking ahead to our 14th birthday, I was expecting something to feel different. I tried to stay busy, but all I could think about was Gennett and what she might be up to in Asmara. I hoped she was homebound, miserable, and missing me. Without Gennett as a witness, nothing I did was meaningful. Late on a Tuesday evening, I watched Ghosh in Operating Theatre 3 as he removed a gallbladder. When he was done, we swung by the surgical ward to see Etienne, a diplomat from Ivory Coast, a man we knew socially who'd suddenly developed a bowel obstruction. In surgery, Ghosh had found an obstructing rectal cancer which he was forced to resect. It was a big and challenging operation, and I knew Ghosh was hopeful for a cure. But he was forced to create a colostomy on the belly wall. Etienne's very depressed, Ghosh said. Not about the cancer, but over his colostomy. He can't accept the idea of waste coming out from an opening in his abdomen. Etienne had the sheet over his head. When Ghosh examined him and then said the colostomy looked beautiful, tears welled up in Etienne's big eyes. He wouldn't look down there. All he said was, "Who will marry me now?" Ghosh was surprisingly firm. "Etienne, that's not the part of your body I cut off, the marrying part. You'll find a woman who loves you and you'll explain it to her. If she loves you for yourself, you'll both be glad that you are alive." Ghosh's facial expression brooked no argument, but then he softened. "Etienne, imagine if all humans were born with their anus on the belly, and that's where everyone's waste emerged.
Then, imagine if someone said they were going to operate on you and reroute your bowel so it opened behind you, between your buttock cheeks, somewhere where you couldn't see it except in a mirror and where you could hardly reach it or easily keep it clean. It took a few seconds, but then Etienne smiled. He dabbed his eyes. He ventured a glance down at his colostomy. It was a small step in the right direction. Gauche had one more patient to see. He told me to go on home so I wouldn't be late for dinner. The rain began to come down hard and I had no umbrella. I walked under the sheltered walkways connecting the theater to casualty and casualty to the male ward. Where the walkway ended, I dashed across a short gap, leaping over a puddle to arrive at the nurses' quarters. I rarely explored this female warren. It looked deserted. If I went up the long outer balcony and down the stairs at the other end, well, I'd still get soaked, but I'd be 50 yards closer to home before I had to dash out into the rain. I hoped Adam's wife, the keeper of the virgins, with that big cross around her neck, didn't see me because she would chase me out. Upstairs, the doors of the individual nurses' rooms opened onto the shared veranda. They must have all been in the dining room, otherwise they would have been lined up against the veranda railing, teasing out their hair, painting their nails, sewing, and chatting. I heard music from the corner room that had once been my mother's. I'd been up here a few times, but just like her grave, this wasn't a place where I felt her presence. The strangeness of the music, the beat, were what pulled me closer. Guitars and drums in a driving rhythm repeated a musical refrain, first in one register, then another. Of late, some Ethiopian music adopted a Western sound, with horns, snare drums, and a repeating electric guitar riff that took the place of the muffled strings of the krar and the hand clapping. But this wasn't Ethiopian music, and not just because the words were English, albeit in English I couldn't quite understand. This was radically different, like a new color in the rainbow. The door was open a crack. She stood barefoot in the center of the room, her back to me. A white slip exposed her shoulders and ended at the back of her knees. Her head went from side to side, and her long straight hair, conked with chemicals, followed as if welded to her skull. Her hips were driven by the bass line, while her upraised right hand kept the melody. Her left hand must have been pressed to her belly because the elbow jutted out like the handle of a teacup. The music had entered her. It lubricated her joints, softened her bones and flesh to produce this gyrating, fluid, and sensual movement. She turned. Her eyes were closed and her face was tilted up. The lower lip was twisted as if it had been split and had healed out of alignment. I knew that lip, that faintly pockmarked face, though now the pox textured the skin and exaggerated her cheekbones. It was the body I didn't recognize. She'd been a student probationer forever, until Matron, taking pity on her, gave her a new title, staff probationer, which transformed her. From being on the long-term plan, a perpetual student, she became an instructor for incoming probationers. In the classroom, with textbooks that she knew by heart, she could both drive facts into the probationers' heads and demonstrate that it was possible to keep them there, by the manner in which she regurgitated her material, never looking at the text. Normally, she wore her hair pulled off her forehead and neck and gathered into a top bun so tight that it arched her eyebrows. When she crowned this with the winged nurse's cap, it looked as if she'd inverted an ice cream cone on her head. Other than her precarious hairdo, I'd always thought of the staff probationer as plain. At school, I knew girls who were neither ugly nor beautiful, but who saw themselves one way or the other, and that conviction made it come true. Heidi Enquist was gorgeous, but alas, not in her own eyes, and so she lacked the mystery and allure of Rita Vartanian, who, despite her overbite and prominent nose, managed to make Heidi envious.
The probationer was of the Heidi mold. I think that's why she made herself a willing prisoner of a stiff, starched uniform and adopted an unsmiling expression to go with it. The only identity she had was that of being in the nursing profession. In her own eyes, and in the light of the world, she thought she was nobody. I'd always felt the probationer's discomfort around us. But then she was shy around everybody. But I could see now that there was more to her than nursing. The uniform concealed a body full of curves, like the figures Shiva used to draw, and the body moved in ways that would have made a harem dancer jealous. Her eyes were closed. Were she to see me, she'd be startled, embarrassed, and probably furious. I was about to step back when, to my surprise, she stepped forward and pulled me in by my hand, as if a phrase in the song was my cue. She kicked the door shut. The music was louder and more intense inside the room. She had me taking little steps in time to the beat, moving my body this way and that. I was embarrassed at first. I wanted to laugh or say something clever, the way an adult would. But her expression and the throbbing beat made me feel anything but dancing would have been like talking in church. My steps became effortless. I imitated her, my shoulders moving in the opposite direction from my hips. My hands drew figures in the air. The trick was not to think. My body felt segmented, and each segment answered the call of a particular instrument. The pattern of our steps felt inevitable. Just when I mastered that, she pulled me to her, my cheek against her neck, my chest against her breasts, separated from them by the thinnest of materials. I'd never danced before, certainly not like this. I breathed in her perfume and her sweat. She squeezed, taking my breath away, as if to make our two bodies one. She guided my arm so that it was around her, my hand over her sacrum, and I held her close. We never stopped moving. She led. I anticipated her every step, clueless as to where that knowledge came from. We spun, then surged this way, then that, like one organism. I thought of Genet. Emboldened, I led, and she followed. I pressed against the soft flesh where her legs came together, only because she pressed too, grinding her hips into me. Blood surged to my face, to my arms, into my stomach, my groin. The world had fallen away. I was in an elaborate dialogue with her. The music wouldn't stop, and I never wanted it to stop. And just when I thought that, it faded. The American announcer's lazy drawl was so unlike the crisp formal tones of the BBC.
"Well, well," he said. "Mama,
as if he'd seen us carrying on.
"Have you ever heard anything quite like that? This is the Rock of East Africa, East Africa's Big 14 Armed Forces Radio Service, Asmara."
It wasn't a station that I knew existed. I knew of a huge American military presence, a listening post, I'd heard it called, just outside of Asmara in Kagnu. Who knew they had something we could listen to? We were still pressed together, holding the world at bay. She gazed into my eyes. I didn't know if she was about to cry or laugh. All I knew was that I'd have cried with her, or laughed, or got down on all fours and pretended to be Cthulhu if she asked.
"You're so beautiful," I said, surprising myself.
She gasped. My words seemed to ripple through her. Had I said the wrong thing? Her lips quivered. Her eyes shone. She was expressing joy. I'd said the right thing. She lowered her face, brought that lip with the puckered scar and the bulges on either side close to mine. Her mouth overlapped mine, forming a seal. The silliest image entered my mind, and it was that of connecting one garden hose to another. What flowed across wasn't water,
but her tongue.
This time, unlike the pantry with Genet, I received her tongue eagerly. It was so very exciting. I put my hand behind her head. I pressed my body to her, feeling every atom in me gum to a point. I pulled away once to look at her and say, "You're so beautiful," because it was a magical phrase, one I knew I should use often, but only if I believed it to be true. I don't know how long we were coupled by our mouths, but it came most naturally, as if I was satisfying a hunger. I didn't realize this potential existed in me. It carried me forward. Whatever was next, I didn't know, but my body knew. I trusted my body. I was ready. Suddenly, she stepped away. She held me at arm's length. She sat on the edge of the bed. She was crying. Something had happened about which my body had failed to inform me. Or perhaps there was a rule, an etiquette that I'd failed to observe. I eyed the door, measuring my escape.
"Can you ever forgive me?" she said. "Your mother shouldn't have died. Maybe if I told someone she was sick, they could have helped her."
This was astonishing. I could feel the hair on the back of my neck rise. I had entirely forgotten this was my mother's room. I couldn't picture Sister Mary Joseph Braise in here, certainly not with a poster of Venice on the wall, and on another wall a black and white poster of a white singer, his pelvis thrust forward at the microphone stand which he pulled toward him, his face contorted with the effort of singing. I looked back at the staff probationer.
"I didn't know how sick she was," she hiccuped through her tears, just like a baby.
"It's all right," I said, feeling as if someone else gave me those words.
"Say you forgive me."
"I will if you stop crying, please."
"Say it."
"I forgive you." She only cried louder. Someone would hear. I didn't think I was supposed to be in this room, and I certainly wasn't supposed to make her cry.
"I said it. I said I forgive you. Why are you still crying?" "But I almost let you and your brother die. I was supposed to help you breathe when you came out. I was supposed to resuscitate you. But I forgot."
When I first came to this room, I was adrift, feeling as if a part of me was missing, all because Genet was away. Then I'd forgotten all that and found happiness, no, ecstasy, in the dance, a hint of what I wanted with Genet. And now I was adrift again, and confused. Paradise had seemed so close, and now I was clawing through fog. She grabbed my hand and pulled me to her, to the bed.
"You can do anything you want to me. Anytime," she said, tilting her head back, looking up at me as I stood over her.
What did she mean?
"Do what?" I said. "Anything."
She let me go and she fell back on her bed. She was spread-eagled. She was ready for whatever I might want to do. Yes, there was something I wanted to do. If I were given free rein, dominion over her body, I knew I'd discover it by instinct. I had a general idea. I was nearly 14 after all. She was giving me license, and still I waited. She rolled over onto her belly, showing me her buttocks and peering at me over her shoulder. Her eyelids were puffy, her expression dreamy and far away. She spun 180 degrees so her head faced me. She propped herself up on her elbows. Her breasts hung down, the nipples barely concealed. She followed my gaze to her cleavage. I heard voices and footsteps outside. The other nurses and probationers were back from dinner. I didn't want to leave, but the world had intruded. My hesitation doomed me. That and her uninvited confession.
"I want to dance with you again," I said in a whisper. You can, she whispered, but as if that were the wrong answer. I do want to do anything with you. Yes, that's what I want too. She was kneeling on the bed now, brightening, smiling through her tears. Come, she said, arms extended, beckoning. But nothing right now. I'll be back another day. I put my hand on the doorknob. But how about anything now? She said, loud enough for the world to hear. I slipped out quickly, hoping that if anyone saw me, they'd think it perfectly normal for me to visit. The rain hadn't let up. I let it beat on my head. I didn't mind. Rain was familiar. But this balancing on the edge of feeling so powerful they seemed capable of making me fly, this was a revelation. By the time I reached our quarters, I was soaked. When I saw the door to Rosina and Gennett's room, I longed for the padlock not to be there. I stood staring at that closed door. It was at that moment, with raindrops smacking me on the fontanelle, that I came to the decision that I must marry Gennett. Yes, that was my destiny. What I felt with the probationer, I never wanted to feel with anyone but Gennett. There were too many temptations out there, great forces ready to shake me free of my avowed intent. I wanted to succumb to temptation, but with just one woman, and that was Gennett. If I married her, I'd solve everything. It would keep Rosina from pulling away. It would make Hema, Ghosh, and Rosina happy, and they'd have both of us as their children. I could see us having kids of our own. We'd tear down the servants' quarters and build the twin to the main house with a linking corridor so we could all be under the same roof. We'd have a room, or maybe a suite, for Shiva. He'd be happy to have Gennett as a sister-in-law. Since Shiva wasn't one to look back, to celebrate the past, it was all the more important for me to preserve the family, keep us as one. I stepped into the house, dripping water on the floor. In the bathroom, I stripped naked and studied myself in the mirror, looking to see what the probationer saw. I was tall for my age, nearly 6 feet, and my skin was fair. I could perhaps have passed for someone of Mediterranean ancestry. My irises were brown. I never saw the hint of blue I could see in Shiva's. My expression seemed unduly earnest, particularly when my hair was damp. Once it dried, the curls would return and it would have a life of their own, refusing to be corralled. This is what it means to arrive at manhood, I thought, hands on my hips, turning to admire my flanks, my buttocks. I dressed and returned to the kitchen, breathing in the scent steaming out of the pots and snatching a piece of meat before Almaz could slap my hand away. She scolded me, but it was a sweet sound, as was the music from the living room with the heavy beat of a tabla and the thump and thud of Hema and Shiva dancing, of Hema calling out instructions. I heard the rattle of the loose bumper on the Volkswagen as Ghosh came up the driveway. I felt ecstatic, as if I were at the epicenter of our family, missing only Gennett and Rosina, who surely would come back, and then our family would be whole. I pushed out of my mind what the probationer said about what she'd done, or hadn't done, for my mother. There wasn't any point in dwelling in the pain of the past, not when the future could hold such pleasure. And as for my father? No, he wouldn't ever walk through those gates. I now knew that. Whatever Thomas Stone had, wherever he was at this moment, he had no idea what he'd given up in the exchange. Chapter 32. A Time to Sow. Gennett and Rosina returned 2 days before school began. They arrived with the clamor and excitement of the Indian circus coming to the Mercato. Their taxi from the bus station sagged on its springs, the roof carrier and trunk so laden with goods. The first thing I noticed was Rosina's gold tooth and the grin that went with it. Genet, too, was transformed, radiant, wearing a traditional cotton skirt and tight bodice, with a matching shama around her shoulders. She shrieked with happiness as she leaped out to hug Hema, almost knocking her over. Then she rushed to Ghosh, then Shiva, then Almaz, and me, and then back into Hema's arms. When Rosina hugged me, it was loving and affectionate, but her lengthy embrace of Shiva made me feel a stab of envy. Her absence allowed me to now see clearly what I'd overlooked before, that she favored Shiva. Was this a result of her seeing me in the pantry with her naked daughter? Or had she always had a soft spot for Shiva? And was I the only one to notice? They were all talking over one another now. Rosina, one arm still around Shiva, allowed Gibru to admire her gold tooth.
Genet, darling, your hair,
Hema said, because it was braided into tight cornrows like her mother's, each braid springing free at the back of her head where it was tied around a shiny disc.
You cut it? I know, don't you love it? And see my hands, she said.
Her palms were orange with henna.
But it's so short. And you pierced your ears, darling, Hema said.
Blue hoops hung down from her lobes.
My God, girl,
she said, holding Genet by the shoulders.
Look at you. You've grown taller and fuller.
Your tits are bigger, Shiva said.
Shiva!
Hema and Ghosh said at the same time.
Sorry, he said, surprised by their reaction. I meant her breasts are bigger, he said.
Shiva! That isn't the sort of thing you say to a woman,
Hema said.
I can't say it to a man,
Shiva said, looking impatient.
It's all right, Ma, Genet said. And it's true, I'm a B, or maybe even a C,
she said, looking down proudly at her breasts, which pointed up like stargazers. Rosina could tell what was being discussed.
Stai zitto,
she said to Genet, her finger on her lips, which made Genet laugh.
Madam,
Rosina said to Hema in Amharic,
I've had my hands full with this girl. All the boys are chasing her. Does she have the sense to discourage them?
No.
And look how she dresses.
I was distressed to hear a trace of pride in her complaint. Genet said, I just love the clothes in Asmara.
Oh, I brought postcards. Dove la mia borsetta, mamma? I want to show you. Oh, it's in the taxi. Hold on.
She went headfirst through the open window of the taxi, treating us to a view of her panties. Rosina screamed at her in Tigrinya to no avail. Genet thrust postcards at us.
Oh, Asmara, you can't imagine what a beautiful city the Italians built so long ago. See?
It wasn't something to brag about, being colonized for so long before Ethiopia. The strange, colorful buildings were all angles, like something out of a geometry set. Hema and Ghosh soon drifted back into the house. The taxi driver helped Gibru unload wooden stools and a new bed into Rosina's quarters. The bed was made of hand-carved dark wood, a gift from Rosina's brother in Asmara, we learned. I sat on the new bed, gazing at Genet. It felt as if she'd been away for years. I was tongue-tied.
So, how was your winter, Marion?
If I was unsure of myself in front of her, she didn't know the meaning of shy. I'd saved up things to tell her. I even had a script. But this tall, beautiful girl, this woman, I should say, sitting next to me, so Eritrean and so enamored of things Italian, messed up my speech. The patients I'd seen, the books I'd read, none of this could compete with Asmara. Oh, nothing really, I said. You know how it is here in the long rains.
That's it? Nothing? No movies, no adventures, and girlfriends?
I was still smarting from Rosina's description of the boys chasing Gennet and Asmara. It was a betrayal. Surely Gennet had a role in that. What boy would bother you if you told him to get lost?
Well, I said, I don't know about girlfriends, but... Reluctantly at first, I told her about my visit to my mother's old room, but I recast my time with the probationer as something casual, portraying myself as the indifferent participant. However, the further I got into the story, the less I was able to sustain that tone. Gennet's eyes became as round as the hoops on her ears.
"So you did it with her?" she said.
"No!"
I said. She seemed disappointed, when I would have expected her to be jealous.
"For God's sake, Marion, why not?"
I shook my head.
"I didn't because..."
"Because what? Spit it out!"
she said, poking my side, as if to help the words come out.
"Who are you waiting for? The Queen of England? She's married, you know."
"I didn't do it because... I knew it would be wonderful, more than wonderful. I knew it would be fantastic."
"What kind of explanation is that?" she said, rolling her eyes in frustration.
"But... I knew I wanted my first time to be with you."
"There, I said it." Gennet looked at me for the longest time, her mouth open. I felt vulnerable. I held my breath, hoping what came out of her mouth next wouldn't be mockery or amusement. Ridicule would destroy me. She leaned over, her eyes soft, her expression loving and tender, and she took my chin in both her hands and shook it side to side as if I were a little baby.
"Mace mincia?"
Rosina asked, her hands on her hips, rudely interrupting us. I hadn't noticed her come back into the room. Gennet burst out laughing. Rosina didn't find it amusing, but Gennet was losing her breath, keeling over. Rosina glared at her, then gave up, muttering to herself. This hysterical laughter of Gennet's was something new. When she could speak, Gennet explained,
"Mace mincia means what the fuck?" which I kept saying in Asmara. I learned it from my cousins. My mother threatened to slap me every time I said it, and now she says it. Can you believe it? So, Marion, Cemincia, eh?
We had dinner together in the bungalow, Gennet seated with us, while Rosina and Almaz ate in the kitchen. It had become my practice to take over the Grundig once we'd eaten. Often, I listened to the Rock of Africa till midnight when it went off the air. The music spoke to what I was feeling. In the tight structure of a 12-bar blues or in Dylan's haunting ballads, order was imposed. Shiva sat with me most evenings. The music spoke to him, too. Now the DJ came on.
"Rock of East Africa, AFRS Asmara, where everyone is a mile and a half high. This is a Boone's Farm Saturday here at the base. The first shipment of Boone's Farm wine came in last night, and folks, if you missed it, I hate to tell you, but it's all gone, and so are some people here. Now let's listen to Bobby Vinton, My Heart Belongs to Only You."
I was pleased to find Gennet knew nothing of this radio station. The cousins in Asmara couldn't be that cool if they never tuned in to this show. The next song began without any introduction. I jumped up.
"This is it," I said to Gennet. "This is the tune I was telling you about."
In all the evenings of listening to the radio, here, for the first time, was a song that I'd heard in the probationer's room. I was shimming and twisting to the music, blind to Hema's shocked expression and the stares of Ghosh and Gennet. I cranked the volume up. Rosina and Almaz came out of the kitchen. They must have thought I was mad. This was out of character for me, but I couldn't stop myself, or I chose not to, and something told me this was the day for it. Now Shiva stood up and joined me, and his dancing was smooth, silky, and so polished, as if all his lessons with Hema had been a way of biding time till he heard this song. That was all it took for Gennet to jump in.
I pulled Hema up from her chair, and soon she moved in time to the music. Ghosh needed no urging. I tried to pull Rosina in, but she and Almaz fled to the kitchen. The fire